ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Welcome to this conversation again, and thanks for taking your valuable time. I know that you're all very busy, and to have a chance to be together just to explore ways in which to raise the consciousness, to come to higher consciousness. What is the name? This is called conscious living, right? Yeah, conscious living. So, I mean, what is living anyway? Oftentimes, when we meet people, we talk about what have you been doing? And that goes a little against the idea that we're human beings. Are you a human being or human doing? So to having a little time just to examine what our actual being is, who are we? And today especially looking at the mind, because you only get one and you can make the best of it. It's a concept that I really hooked onto when I read in the Bhagavad Gita that the mind can be the worst friend or the best friend or the worst enemy. And that yoga is really about amending the mind and helping to train it and to become a friend. And when I thought of algorithms as formulas for solving problems, mind does that quite readily. Any problem that you give the mind, it immediately begins working on it. And there are algorithms that can throw us off course, and there's algorithms that can help keep us on course as well. So we'll talk a little bit about that today in the short time that we have together, and hopefully take away a few things that we can use practically in our lives. And I'll draw from the wisdom literatures like Bhagavad Gita, the Yoga Sutras, teachings of the ancient teachers of yoga and meditation to bring out a few points, and some modern examples also. So let's start by doing a little introspection, just a short meditation to get centered. And if you'll find a comfortable way to sit in your chair, and then make your spine just a little bit straighter than it was a second ago, because as soon as you do, you'll feel that you're coming to attention. And just relax and bring your awareness inwardly. And just be aware of your internal environment. You can notice a couple things that you might have not noticed a few seconds ago, which is that you're breathing. And if you just take a moment to observe your breath, bring your attention to your breath, and then also think of your breath as a gift. I take it for granted all day long, but actually, it's coming to me as a gift. If you relax a little more, and then be aware that you're breathing out, and then pulling in energy when you inhale. When you exhale, mentally say, out. And when you inhale, mentally say, in. Now notice that you're the one observing your breath, which means you're separate from the breath. It's going on, but you're watching it. And then notice that you can watch your thoughts. Just be observant of thought energy. The mind is very subtle. It shifts constantly. And you can watch the energy of the mind. And notice that you're not your mind. And now just bring your attention to your right hand. And notice that your right hand has energy that you can feel. And also notice that you're the one observing your hand. When you talk about your hand, you don't say, "I hand," you say, "my hand." Because your hand and you are different. The observer and the hand, two things exist separately. Now bring your attention to your heart center. This is the center of emotion. It's a very powerful center. And we'll try a mantra together. But when you say it from your heart center rather than your tongue or your brain. We'll say it out loud, but see that it's coming from your heart. This is a very beautiful two-syllable mantra. First syllable is ra, and the second is ma. And it means the highest spiritual love and happiness. So I'll say it one time. And then we'll say it together 5 times in unison. Rama, 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 Rama. Rama. And now just take a moment to notice that at any time you can look inwardly, and just like the ocean, there's a surface to the ocean and underneath there's a world that we barely ever notice. Taking time to go deep within, to notice the difference between myself and my mind and my body, can give us balance, the wisdom to make good choices by perspective. We can actually find happiness. Take a couple more relaxing breaths. And just rub your palms together slowly to create some energy. Hold your hands in front of your face and then open your eyes and come back into the room. And welcome back. So this kind of introspection is something that's recommended in the wisdom literatures that talk about yoga and meditation, because there's actually something there that we can look at. I definitely look at something because I'm constantly surveying the world and looking for an object that will give me some kind of satisfaction. But there's something that's the most satisfying, and that's observing ourselves, according to the Bhagavad Gita. You can see that you exist, that you're cognizant, and that's the most, actually, the interesting thing that we can find when we actually connect with it. The self can become conscious of itself. One of the ways in which the algorithms of the mind bring anxiety is through us becoming caught up in its currents. There are various algorithms that my mind can pick up from the world. For instance, if someone tells me early on in life that I'm no good or I'll never amount to anything, and I might keep that algorithm. It might go around and around in my mind. Or I might have an algorithm that there's a certain thing that I need to make myself complete, feel complete, and that keeps running. And those kinds of algorithms are known as the disturbance of the mind. And having the wherewithal to actually look at them carefully, deliberate on them, where are they actually taking me, and at the same time observing what I am as the observer, as something that's categorically different from the energy of the mind and even of the physical body, is a very centering and helpful exercise. Do you have any comments or reflections about going through the very short meditation that we just did? Were you raising your hand? Okay. Just reflect back how it was.
Calms the mind down.
Did it calm your mind down? Did you feel that? Was there a certain point at which you felt that that happened? Like you noticed that you were calmer?
At the end. I mean, I know that it happened throughout the meditation, but I guess I was aware of it at the end. Definitely after a day of work, you kind of accelerate it.
Yeah.
So it's good to...
And this is an excellent point that you mentioned the word aware. And it's possible to be really absorbed in my life situation and not see my life. And to make a distinction between the two, my life is the conscious observer that's looking out at the world. And my life is everything that's going on around me. So this is becoming aware and seeing the difference helps to make a gap between my life situation and my actual life. And this is one of the points of this, is just to be aware and be aware that you're aware. Because it's possible to be unaware also. Any other reflection?
I got into it. It took me a while to release outside. But the moment you said about the breath, something we take for granted, that really connected a lot.
Nice. That's a really nice algorithm, and I'm using that word freely today because I named the talk today, the amending the mind's algorithms. And gratitude is an algorithm. It's really powerful because it leads back to this connection with something that's benevolent. There's a way another algorithm, I can think the whole world's against me, and whatever happens, I start to see it as I'm being victimized somehow. And gratitude really reverses that mind algorithm that I'm being victimized, to see that actually that I'm being supported and there's an abundance in my life. I could take things for granted and I can forget about them, but it's really powerful. Just take a moment to be grateful for the most basic things. The other day I was just drawing water out of the tap, and I was thinking that, you know, I can't take it for granted. It's really an amazing, I mean, what is water anyway when you think about it? It gives life to everything. You just pour it on something and all of a sudden it comes alive. And, you know, I can just take it for granted and waste it. And I can do that with any resource, internally or externally, but gratitude is one of the most powerful algorithms for adjusting the mind and bringing it to reality. How about one more reflection? You were going to say.
The peace I'm looking for is within. Like, I just reflect back, I find the happiness. Outside, I look for so many times for mobile screen, for other things, to just feel better. But just sitting and introspecting inside, I can get that.
Yeah, it's nice to know, because it's practically cliche to say that happiness comes from within. I mean, how many times have you heard it? But actually to experience it. I mean, to hear the theory is one thing, but experience it for yourself. And this idea of introspection, that if you have one glimpse of the fact that you actually exist, it's very immediately fortifying. And it also can bring one to a position of natural happiness. Because this is what's described, our consciousness is actually free. But I become attached to the various material things around me. So I'll just explain that a little more. The Bhagavad Gita makes a distinction between matter and what we'll call antimatter, or something that's categorically different. So the consciousness can't be described by physics, mathematics, and so forth, because it's beyond the realm of the physical nature. Whereas the physical nature has certain elements that we can identify, and it has certain characteristics. It's also very mystical as well. It's hard to fathom the complexity of material nature itself. But according to the wisdom literatures like Bhagavad Gita, Yoga Sutra, the consciousness itself is categorically different from that, from the material elements. They name them in this way: earth, water, fire, air, ether, which means mind space, ether, bhumir, apu, analo, vayu, kammano, the mind, intelligence, and ahankar, which means ego. And these are all considered gross and subtle elements. And then beyond that is the conscious self called the Atma. And the Atma is the animator of the body, also the observer. So let's look at this this sheet here that says mind on the top of it. And this is a mnemonic that my colleague Chaitanya Charan had put together that I found very useful. So he starts off with this statement: the life naturally brings us problems, but our minds determine the size of our problems. Prakashori likes that. She's smiling. Okay. So the first, the M in mind is mystical. John Milton, the poet, said, "The mind is a universe that can make a heaven out of hell or a hell out of heaven." So this is something that we might have experienced in ourselves. And here's a scenario. So would somebody please read this aloud who's got a nice loud voice?
In anticipation, you attend an event after learning that there will be cheesecake served for dessert. When the event is over, you find out that due to a glitch with the caterers, there will be no cheesecake served. Suddenly, your anticipation of happiness turns to lamentation. At the same event, a diabetic who loves cheesecake suddenly feels happy when she hears there will be no cheesecake. She has been lamenting that she'd not be able to eat it. The mind is mystical, as it determines our experiences regardless of the circumstances.
So the scenario, this is the same. There's two people there. They both have minds. Cheesecake is involved. And they react to it in different ways, because they interpret it different ways. One of them, but both of them are processing it through the mind. It's a mental exercise, because one is thinking, I have to have cheesecake, and then the cheesecake doesn't come. And so now I feel disturbed. And the other one is worried that when the cheesecake comes, everyone's going to be eating it, and I won't be able to eat it anyway. So when it doesn't come, she becomes happy. So this is the way that the mind is interacting with the external world all the time, processing. Now the next one is the eye is impressionable. So our past actions form impressions on our mind. Whatever we do, especially repeatedly, gets impressed on the mind. These impressions become the basis of our perceptions, biases, and aspirations, what to speak of our anxieties and fears. So there's a way in which the state of our mind is how we perceive the world. As we've said before in these sessions, that it's not what happens to us. In fact, I have the quote on the next page. It's Epictetus said, you're not upset about what happens to you, but what you think happens to you. That's on page 2 of 2 in the next section. In Aspects of the Mind. I'm sort of jumping ahead, but you see Epictetus under Aspects of the Mind, you're not upset about what happens to you, but about what you think happens to you. So the mind develops impressions, and it becomes conditioned in a certain way, so then whatever happens, it perceives it in various ways. So it's one of the determinants of the way that we move in the world, of how the mind has been formed through taking in impressions. So what's M for? M stands for mystical. I stands for? And N means neutral. The mind only gives back to us what we put into it. Our inputs create impressions in the mind. Changing your input changes your impressions, which reshapes your mind. The neutrality of the mind can be equated to the property of the blotting paper. So blotting paper picks up everything, and then you'll notice that that's what the paper looks like, whatever you have exposed it to. So similarly, the mind is neutral to begin with, but when you expose it to various kinds of subjects, then it takes on that nature. It's malleable in that way. One of my mantras is, if you don't like what you're being subjected to, then change the subject. Because oftentimes we tune in to various subjects even though we don't like them. The other day I was considering the term breaking news. Have you ever heard that? Ha ha ha. I'm just joking. I know everyone's heard of it. Okay, breaking news, and I was thinking, what does it actually mean? I was thinking it's breaking my concentration from things that are actually important. It's also breaking my heart by giving me information about very sad events that I can't do anything about. So there are ways in which we can subject ourselves to information, sound vibration that actually causes distress, and it disturbs the algorithms in the mind. So the mind's neutral, but we have to be the parent in the room and decide what goes in, because it all stays in there. And then the last one is directable. This is great news, this last one, that it's directable, and that is the mind can be directed and reformed by mode of goodness, lifestyle changes, karma yoga, and mantra meditation. I've just mentioned several things there that are known for amending the mind's algorithms. Lifestyle changes, I think we talked about it a little earlier, just there's ways in which when you change your environment, and there are things that have to do with what you're listening to, the diet you have, and so forth, that actually have a systemic effect on your body and mind. And there are many instructions about how to amend the mind and help direct it in the proper way. It can be reformed. So here are a few of the analogies that can help us when we're thinking about the mind. So one of them is the computer. A computer has hardware, software, and it has a user. So we can think of the body and mind, the physical part of it, to be like the hardware of the computer. And then the mind, which is a subtle energy, is like the software. And I mentioned that there's gross and subtle energies that are all material, and that the user is beyond that. So in this case, the physical shape and substance of the mind is like the hardware, but there is a mind substance, which is subtle, which is software that runs the mind. It's the mind energy that you can observe for yourself. And then finally, there's the user, and that's you. So the next analogy sort of helps to conceptualize us as the user, and that's the idea of the lens. So just imagine we're in this building now. I mean, you don't have to imagine you're in it, so just look around. But imagine there's five security cameras downstairs at five different doorways. You have that? And then we're sitting up here, or let's just say you're sitting alone in a room, and you're looking at five screens that are showing what's on those particular cameras, or the information that's coming through those cameras. You have that? Five cameras downstairs, now you have five screens. Why do you think I picked five? What? Well, you're so fast, you ruin everything. Thank you very much. So, what five senses?
The eyes, ears, nose.
Where are they? Maybe point to them.
Eyes, ears.
You notice that most of them are grouped up here? They're all, like, focused. I mean, we just think of it, it's just a face, you know. What are ears anyway? I mean, if you actually stop for a while in the mirror and start looking at your ear, you'll kind of get freaked out because you're like, well, what is that? But it's a little satellite dish. These senses are actually active portals, and they're pulling information from outside. And, I mean, the eye is literally a lens. And if you look at it and, you know, put the light up and down, you'll watch it open and close. And you'll notice it's a mechanical device. So all that information's coming somewhere. So now imagine that the security person is watching these five screens, and then there's an intruder at one of the doors, and he shows up on one of the screens. What'll happen then?
Focus on that screen.
He'll focus on the screen, right. So we're watching as the observers, we're watching the information come in, and we sort of naturally put our attention on the important information, what we consider is important when it comes in. For instance, if we're talking now and you're concentrated on what I'm saying, and then all of a sudden a bee stings you on your leg, then you lose your concentration and everything will go to that screen. Because what just happened there? And all your attention will get pulled in that way. So these kinds of examples are throughout the wisdom literatures. Of course, these are a little modernized, but they try to give us a sense of seeing the difference between the observer and the mechanism that's bringing it to us. And the next one is the horse. So does anybody here have a horse? If you did, could you bring it to Google? I just wanted to see what their rules are here. So horses and people do get along well. People who have horses love their horses, and the horses love them, it seems. And in the beginning, it's not always like that. Have you ever seen the relationship of a man and a horse when the man's trying to chain a wild horse? Where have you seen it? On the movies? And have you ever heard of a horse whisperer? Who's heard of it? What is it?
He can understand what a horse wants.
Yeah, have you ever seen that?
I heard of dog whisperers.
Dog whisperers? Yeah, there are a lot of different kind of whisperers. The horse whisperers, there were several documentaries about horse whisperers, and it's uncanny if you watch them. Everybody else, the horse goes... runs around and tries to get away, but the horse whisperer will walk in, knows how to stand, knows the body language that the horse will respond to, and knows how to develop trust. And then it has various sounds that the horse whisperer will make, and the horse responds, and gradually the horse will come to the person and make friends. And it takes some time for the horse whisperer to tame the horse. So this is a very common analogy about the mind. It's like a horse. And now, if you just get on a wild horse and you don't mind where it takes you, you won't really notice its independent nature. But if you get on a horse and you expect it to go in a certain direction, you'll you'll notice that if it's not trained properly, if it hasn't developed that algorithm that when I say, you know, right, or I sort of put a little pressure with my right foot, then we turn right, then it'll go any other direction, and you'll feel a little frustrated. So similarly with the mind, this analogy holds that the mind when it's untrained. Or let's put it another way. If you try to control your mind, like focus. Have you ever had a situation where you tried to focus and you couldn't? Recently? Please say yes, it'll make me feel better. Happens to me every day. You know, it's always, in fact, I read a book. I was writing a book recently and finished it gladly. While I was writing, I used to spend a lot of time at the library. I'd walk down to the Burlingame Library and I'd go in there and I'd find books on how to write a book and how not to procrastinate when writing a book. And what most of them said, go back and write your book, stupid. But one of them I found was a book called The War of Art. No, it's not The Art of War, it's The War of Art. Because this author writes about how whenever we try to focus the mind, especially on something creative, and especially on writing, is the way the mind has this incredible force called what he calls resistance, and he spells it with a capital R. He says it's practically impossible to control the mind. He points out that Adolf Hitler was actually an artist, but instead of doing his art, he went off and started world wars and so forth. He kind of gives evidence that, you know, this is a really formidable force to deal with. And according to the wisdom literatures, it's actually the mind, the force of the mind being unruly and untrained. So what would be the relationship that a person would have with the mind who is able to actually control it and have the power of focus? Other things might come in, like the power of forgiveness, because you might have a different perspective on why things are happening and how they're happening when you're able to control your mind. So the endeavor of amending the mind and changing the algorithms is something like training a horse. It takes a little work and practice. It's a discipline. But it's the most important of all disciplines that we can perform in our lives. It has the highest payoff. Before I go to the next two, which I think are really nice also, let's just take a few reflections. Reflections are fun. Just take a minute to relax. Like, let yourself loose and pretend that you're hanging out with your best friends in your in the safest environment you can think of, and nobody's going to judge you, and then just reflect back anything that you heard so far. Don't try to filter it in your mind and think whether it's worthy or not. Just blurt it out. Yeah.
It's really difficult.
Thank you. That's a really important point. And this point actually comes up in the Bhagavad Gita. And it's in the section, it's in the sixth chapter, which is on meditation. It's called Dhyan Yoga. Dhyan means to meditate. So the student says to the teacher, I think this is impossible. I can't do this. And he says that the mind, he gives a characteristic, the mind is like the raging wind. And also, he gives three characteristics of the mind. He says it's balavad, means very strong. He says it's crazy, as in, mad, crazy, and also very determined. So chanchalam hi mana krishna. So he says chanchalam means, so if you bring a child in here that's, let's say, 2.5 years old. Anybody familiar with 2.5-year-old child? Say, you have one, okay. If we brought your 2.5-year-old child into the room here, we would be having a slightly different kind of conversation. I just came back from Japan. A lot of places where I travel, I don't have control over the environment, and you know, people bring their 2.5-year-olds, and they're thinking like, great, they'll really appreciate a philosophical discussion. the point is, they're called chanchal. Chanchal means they're all over the place. One minute they're picking something, the next time put it down. One minute they're laughing, next minute they're crying. And they're constantly moving. So the mind's like that. It's called chanchal. And then the other one is balavad, means very strong. And then dridham means very determined also. So now if we bring somebody in here who's, you know, chanchal and very strong and very determined, our whole day is going to be ruined. What to speak if we live with that entity all the time. So what's the answer when the student says that? The teacher says, Krishna says, okay, you can do it, but it takes right practice and detachment. You have to keep practicing and don't give up, and be detached. So this is one of the ways in which you deal with the mind. You have to be a little bit detached, and at the same time, employ the disciplines which are offered in the practices of yoga and meditation. So he says, then you can do it. Gradually you can bring the mind. Now in bhakti yoga, there's a little different approach than like an Ashtanga process, where you very mechanically stair-step your way up to controlling the mind. The bhakti process is the yoga of love and gratitude. So love is the most powerful emotion. When we actually are attached to somebody out of love, or even out of gratitude, which is like a precursor to love, then it's so compelling that we sort of naturally fix our minds in a certain way, and the mind becomes controlled. Like if you love somebody, it's probably impossible to stop thinking about them. And one of the objects of yoga, or the goals of yoga, is attained through being fixed in this kind, or absorbed in this kind of love and gratitude. One more reflection from the spontaneous platform. Spontaneously blurt out your reflection, please.
I like that point you mentioned about how the mind can make the mole into a mountain and the mountain into a mole.
Yeah.
And sometimes because of our preconceived notions, very, very simple situations can seem really, really huge. But for any other normal person, it may just be, you know, just a comment or just an incident. But for us, because the mind tends to hold on to backlogs of information and feelings and emotions, it just perceives in a certain way. And I think that contributes to the fact that some situations are blown out of proportion.
Good point. Yeah. Let's do a scenario. Let's say you walk past your boss. They still have bosses? I'll take that as a yes. Okay, let's say you walk past your boss in the hallway and she looks at you kind of, or she doesn't look at you, just walks past you, kind of ignores you. Then what goes through your mind? Probably doesn't like my work. I'll probably get fired on the next round, and that means I'll get kicked out of my place. And a few more ticks down and I'm on the street homeless. And none of it's actually happened, and probably none of it's actually true. In fact, in a lot of studies I've read, most of the things people worry about never come true. But the mind takes that algorithm and goes into that mode of catastrophizing and taking it to the worst place that it possibly could. Is that what you were saying?
Yes.
Something like that? Yeah, so that's one of the algorithms that the mind can go through and take us in various ways. So what other reflections do you have?
Some of the algorithms are really well-intended. It's like they just get amplified in ways that are really unhelpful. So for instance, the thing about your boss, like anticipating situations that might harm your survival is a really great algorithm because it keeps you more, you know, able to be in the world. It just gets so amplified and so unhelpful. So it's this really interesting thing, like the base of the algorithm seems to be really great, and the way it gets executed just takes us over.
Yeah, so in one of the sections, and I'm not being systematic here, but we're going through and talking about a lot of the ideas of working with that over amplification is through deliberation. The very word deliberation has the word Libra in it, which means to be balanced. You know, Libra, the scales. You know these pan scales? And so deliberation means to think about things ahead of time or while you're experiencing them and weigh them out. And when it's out of balance, when your consideration or your deliberation isn't properly done, then you may overemphasize certain things. The algorithm may go into that catastrophizing place where it's just too much. So there's a cycle that I mentioned here, we've talked about previously, that takes place where I perceive something. And interestingly, that we don't perceive things unless we're focused on them. And we proved that before in one of our sessions when we talked about how, let's say if you're reading a book and then your eyes are going over the paragraph and you're reading the words, but then all of a sudden you start thinking about how your taxes are due. Or you remember it's the 16th and I actually didn't do my taxes. And I'm sorry to bring that up, but but you might get to the bottom of the page and then realize, you know, my eyes read this, but I didn't absorb any of it. So the first thing is perception. And we have to notice that we have to actually focus on something to perceive it. Once we perceive something, then there's a way in which, we can just turn to it because it might be helpful. You can look at the... aspects of the mind. So first is perception, and the second is interpretation. So that, as we talked about before, depends on the condition of the mind. Because someone whose mind is disciplined, for instance, they practice introspection, therefore they're a little calmer in dealing with these kinds of things, and they realize that the world going on around me has its patterns. They're not so caught up in the reaction of it all. And that interpretation takes place based on the quality of the mind. And whatever interpretation I make, when I overemphasize, then there'll be a bodily response. For instance, if you were sitting here and you hear somebody's car get hit outside, and then you think, oh, that's right where I parked. And then you start to your heart palpitates, and you begin to perspire. And then you run to the window and you look out, and it's not your car. It's your boss's car. And now you suddenly feel different because it's not your car. But the point is that the body starts to go into the reaction mode according to what the mind tells it. It interpreted something, and then it told the body, like, this is what's happening. Now this is the very end of the loop. Or there is no end to a loop, but I guess that's the point. But the fact is that it tells the body, you know, freak out. The body freaks out, and then the mind gets it back again, that the body's freaking out. Therefore, what I interpreted must be true. And so it stays in that loop. Through introspection, through mantra meditation, learning a little perspective through deliberation and introspection, one can be more aware of that loop. And just say, hey, come on, you guys. You know, that's survival mode. And the idea of survival a lot has to do with the mammalian, you know, features that we have, that actually we could be, we could suffocate at any time, or there are a lot of things that can happen to us on a physical level. But one of the points of introspection of seeing our consciousness is that I'm separate from that. Those reactions that are going on in the body and the need for survival is something that doesn't actually apply to the category of energy that I am. I'm a different category of energy because I'm not extinguishable. That's one of the points that's made in the Bhagavad Gita. The conscious self is never extinguished, whereas the body is constantly being, it's always changing, constantly aging and heading towards a burnout. I mean, it's 98.6. At some point, it's going to burn itself out. So any other reflection before I move to the next analogies? Yes, please. It makes what?
Like, how do you say, it leaves a path, like, yeah. In the body, in the mind, if you leave it. I was surprised how powerful a thought left by itself can be, like, if you don't put the power of, I guess, discrimination, like you said. If you don't look at it.
This is something that comes up in the Yoga Sutra, and that is that when you feed impulses, as an example, an impulse is thought energy, and it also, you know, we feel an impulse, we react to it, and each time that we submit to it, it becomes stronger. Like you might notice, you just say, well, I'll give it to it once, and then tomorrow I won't do it. Like this is the last time, right? Because the next day it comes back, and then it's like, I'm back, and I'm stronger than I was yesterday. And if you give into it again and then again and again, then gradually it becomes an addiction. And even if your intelligence tells you, like, this is really bad, by the way, your career is being ruined. I mean, there's so many things you could observe from an intellectual level, but it begins to develop a neural pathway, and also the impulse becomes much, much stronger. An example one of my colleagues gives is there's a good dog and a bad dog, and which one becomes stronger? The one you feed. What?
I said the one you feed.
Yeah, thank you. So the one you feed. And similarly, you know, there's good impulses and bad impulses. So the idea of deliberation again comes back. See which, be prepared ahead of time that there's choices to be made. And even the smallest victory on that level, it can be encouraging. And then the next day you come back, and just the way you'd give into a bad habit, you start to develop strength on the other side in your mind to develop good habits. Yes. Yes, absolutely. And you know, this is something I thought about the other day. Have you ever shopped when you're hungry? Don't do it. I mean, I've heard it so many times. I don't really shop that much, but it happened when I was in Japan. I had to go in and buy some stuff, and I was really hungry. And so then I was looking at everything and go, I could take that whole rack, you know. But when you get home, he's like, you have no refrigerator, and you know, like, what are you going to do? Your perception is out of alignment when you're hungry and you shop. So in a similar way, don't go out and interact with the world and interact with the relationships before you have this experience, the inner experience of feeling whole in yourself. This is altogether possible to actually experience a wholeness in yourself, which I would compare to feeling full after you've eaten. And when you have that, then you deal with situations much differently, just the way when you go to shop, when you just ate. Now that's a good time to shop. You know, it's like, how much is that? I'll take this one instead. And, you know, we don't need that now. We don't need that ever, you know. So those kinds of things, when you are able to touch the spiritual platform, and actually the experience itself is described in the Bhagavad Gita. It says Brahma, Bhuta, Prasanatma. So these are Sanskrit words, and I'll explain them. So Brahma, Bhuta. Means when you touch the spiritual platform, which is not so unusual because that's who you are. You're not the body. You're actually the Atma inside the body who's observing the body. But if you can experience it for yourself and just even have an inkling of it, then the first thing is Prasanatma. Prasanatma means happy for no reason. It's not like you won something, now you're happy, or you got good news and you're happy. It's just you are happy for no reason. That's prasanatma. Your mind becomes happy. And nashochati nakankshati means you don't lament and you don't hanker. So these refer to the past that I could have had, I should have done in the past. You're living in that side. Or in the future, I have to have this, otherwise I won't be happy. So na means not. So you don't have that anymore. Nashochini nakankshati, when you feel full in yourself. And what's the third? Samak sarveshu bhuteshu means that you start to feel a camaraderie with all other life. You start to see it's all the same kind of spiritual, it is the same category of spiritual energy. Therefore, you feel a kind of kinship with other living beings in an uncanny way. Not like in the mind makes these divisions that these are my friends and these are my enemies. Although I'm not saying, you know, you'd go pet a tiger or, you know, vote for somebody you don't like. I'm just saying you'd have this overwhelming sense that actually life is universal, and you're in touch with it. And that's a very high perspective, which gives you the wherewithal to deal with the world in a much more reasonable way than if you're simply following the mind that is sometimes, well, it's compared to all these things we're talking about. Okay, we have time for two more analogies. And if you have questions, too, just really go for it and ask questions. Yeah. Yeah. Well, here's one thing that you've heard before, but we'll bring it up in this context, and then maybe it'll make more sense. If physical pain is inevitable, because these bodies are machines, and they're going to get messed up. But suffering is optional. And so the difference between pain and suffering is that if you're in pain, it's a sensation, whereas suffering means that I become absorbed in it. And a physical pain, just it really has to be managed. And it can be managed much better when we're aware of the fact that this body, first of all, is going to go through a lot of different kinds of changes. Part of it is managing your expectations. If you think you're going to be completely whole and happy and without any kind of infliction at any time in your life, then it worsens the whole scenario. I mean, some people, things happen to them, they're able to deal with it much easier when physical pain comes. There's a book I read a while back called Head Off Stress. I think it was written by a Buddhist, but the point he was making was that for people in chronic pain, and a lot of people with chronic pain read this book, they start observing the pain differently than they were before. They look at it as like an impulse. It's like you can feel some pain and then think, your mind can go through the catastrophizing thing and say, well, that's the end. I'm finished. You know, this is the beginning of the end. This is something. And you start thinking of all the things it could be, and it becomes much, much worse. Or you just have this nondescript feeling that I'm being attacked. You know, something's wrong. And that there's a difference between that and actually observing it carefully and seeing, like, okay, what is it actually? It's an impulse. It's coming in, and there is a way in which one could observe it and say, yeah, it's definitely an impulse. You know, it's loud. You know, it's louder than a lot of impulses, but it is an impulse. And there's a way to deliberate upon it and balance it a little bit more. But the Bhagavad Gita is also very practical, too. And it says, as long as you're in a physical body and mind, there's going to be some kind of, there will be changes which will be disturbing. And the one word that keeps coming up in the Bhagavad Gita, and I hope this is of some consolation, is titiksha, which means learn tolerance. It's a very powerful spiritual practice is to learn to be tolerant. Because many things in this world come and go, and that's the very point he makes in the book, Bhagavad Gita, is that just as the winter and summer seasons come and go, if you just tolerate it. My spiritual master used to give this example. He was from India, and he said sometimes, like in the old days, even in the 1970s, when I used to go to India and get on trains, you'd get on a train that, you know, you didn't have a reservation. Everyone for themselves just get in where you can. So you get on, and then everyone takes a seat, and then you're left without a seat. So then someone who took the last seat, you know, when you were about to. So you can make a big fuss out of it, or you can tolerate and say, it's only an hour or two, whatever, you know, just stand up. And then you don't have a problem anymore. So tolerance is something that's advocated throughout the Bhagavad Gita as a state of consciousness in the conscious being dealing with an ever-changing world. Learn to tolerate it. There's another thing about urges as well. Urges have a way of advertising themselves when they come, and they say, I'm going to be here forever, and I'm never going to leave you alone, unless you give in now. But they're faking you out. I'm not going to use the term, but fake news. But if you wait, and then, you know, a few minutes later, it's like, it's gone. You wait it out. You tolerate it. And that gives you a different perspective, because then you start to see that I don't have to give in to everything. So, a little strength when you develop on that level. Questions are good. Do you have any more?
Like, how does a trained mind look like? Like, would it be that you just, like, it stops sending these types of requests? Or is it more like that you are detached and you're, like, able to sort of not follow them through? Or is it both?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And it goes to the basis of the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita and the Yoga Sutras. It's not that the... we are considered in these literatures to be actually cognitive. And, you know, for instance, even when the senses are dormant, when you're sleeping, the mind's still working. And we're always active. We're creative. And we're active in all states, even when dreaming. So it's not that you can turn it off. But transferring from lower energy to higher energy, the mind can be absorbed in very low energy, or it can be transferred. So even the experiment that you probably know about, the pink monkey, you'll know about pink monkey. They don't teach you that at Google. Okay, the pink monkey experiment. Just let's take 20 seconds. Please don't think of a pink monkey. For you, it's they taught you elephant here? Okay. Well, I come from Burlingame, so they taught us. Are you not thinking of a pink monkey now? Please stop immediately. And so the act of denial is an act of consciousness itself. And whatever you resist persists. And it's similar with our existence, and especially our relationship with the mind. Therefore, the idea more is purification of the mind. If you take out the bad algorithms, or you amend them, rather, then what does it look like? Well, that's described, actually, in one of the chapters in the Bhagavad Gita. The student asks a question. Arjuna says, so what does it look like when somebody actually has a steady mind? It's called sthita prajna. So sthita means to be situated, prajna in higher consciousness. So the answers are commonsensical. The first one that Krishna gives in the Gita, this is in the second chapter, he says, Prajahati yadakaman sarvan parta manogatan atman yiva manatushta stita pragnas tadochite. So tadochite means it's said that the person who is fixed in consciousness, first of all, doesn't feel obligated to grab everything that's coming off the conveyor belt of the mind. So the mind here is described manogata. So gata means to go and go and go. So mano means the mind. So the mind's like a little factory, and it's constantly manufacturing all kinds of stuff, and it just keeps coming off all the time, right? So one of the first symptoms of a person who's fixed in consciousness is, like, I don't have to take everything that comes off that conveyor belt. I can watch it, and I can see that it's going on, but I'm not obligated to take it because my mind and myself are two different things. And then the second thing he says, atman yiva manatushta. So tushta, say tushta, it's a nice word. Tushta. Tushta means satisfaction. And he says, atman yiva manat. So atma means the self. So the person who can feel satisfied in him or herself, actually at any time, just for no reason, feel satisfied, and that person is known to be fixed in consciousness. Because that's our real condition, actually. I only get distracted because I get the wrong algorithms and I start thinking like I need a thing. This is actually propagated. There's a lot of evidence to show how, like, modern consumerism is a way of propagating bad algorithms. It keeps telling people unless you have certain things and a certain look and so forth, you're not going to be happy. But that's not true. Even if you have them, you won't be happy because it's not based on the external condition. It's based on whether or not you can be situated in yourself and feel satisfaction in yourself, and there's satisfaction to be had there. And then he goes on to describe other symptoms of a self-realized person. And another one is that he or she is not disturbed by the dualities of the world, like sukesh shu vigata spriha. Dukeshwanu na, I'm going to try it. There's happiness and distress. So you might think, this happiness is good, distress is bad. But actually, as we proved in that little cheesecake scenario, through the the cheesecake doctrine, that it's not dependent on the thing itself. It's dependent on how you observe the thing. So what's hot weather is bad for one person and good for another. So a person who observes that these dualities are actually just changing and they remain equal in both cases is known to be fixed in consciousness. And there's more. It goes on from there. But that starts from that commonsensical level. So we came together and we had a session of meditation and we had some discussion and we talked about the mind, and hopefully this could be counted as deliberation. And as we go back out into whatever we're going back out into, we'll take the perspective that we've gleaned from the various teachers and wisdom literatures that have been passed down. What do you think? Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for coming. It's been really nice to have you here. And we'll see you again soon. Hey!